A Pictish stone is a monument carved with symbols and inscriptions, such as serpents and the double disc, often with an overlaid Z rod, as you can see here. The Picts were a confederation of peoples who lived in what is today eastern and northern Scotland during the late Iron Age and early medieval periods. The name Picts appears in written records from late antiquity to the 10th century, when they are thought to have merged with the Gaels to form the Kingdom of Alba, which is present-day Scotland. Alba then expanded, and by the 11th century, the Pictish identity had been subsumed into the Scots. The term Pict is thought to have originated as a generic term by the Romans, where the Latin word Picti is taken to mean painted or tattooed people. What the Picts called themselves is unknown.
Mass, pipes and drums! By the Santa! Quick! March!
Tuatha De Danann means tribe of the goddess Danu, a godlike mythological race from pre-Christian Gaelic Ireland. The Tuatha De Danann were descended from Nemed, leader of a previous wave of inhabitants of Ireland. Nemed means privileged or holy in Old Irish. His people or clan are referred to as the Nemedians, and they were said to have had a genealogy going back to the biblical Noah. Nemed was the son of Agnamon of Scythia, and the Scythians have been associated with the tribe of Dan.
Micah in the Bible, the book of Micah, chapter 5, helps prove that the Western tribes were to be identified with the Scythian peoples. The Western tribes were the northern kingdom of Israel. The two sections of the Israelite people was the kingdom of Judah in the south, from which the present-day Jews are developed, and the kingdom of Israel in the north, which comprised 10 tribes. And these 10 tribes were taken into exile by the Assyrians, and they lost consciousness of their ancestry. And we trace them ultimately to Western Europe, to peoples who settled in Western Europe, and from there populated the USA, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and related nations. And these are the lost tribes of Israel. This is where the lost tribes are to be found. Originally there were 12 tribes of Israel. These 12 tribes of Israel were scattered or spread throughout the Middle East. The lands extended from the Nile River to the Euphrates, included parts of Turkey. It also included the Isles of Cyprus, island of Cyprus, and other areas. And they split into two different sections, as we said, the kingdom of Israel in the north, the kingdom of Judah in the south. The kingdom of Israel was taken into exile, and they became lost in terms of Israel. And we trace them, as we said, to Western Europe. The Phoenicians were the descendants of the Canaanites of the Bronze Age, through the Iron Age and Roman period. Phoenicians was a name given to these people by the Greeks, but the Phoenicians continued to refer to themselves as Canaanites or by the names of their principal cities. The Bible records that the Phoenicians had a close relationship with the Israelites. Their royalty married each other, they traded with each other, and significantly, they went to war with each other. In the 18th century, linguists noticed a great similarity between the Phoenician and the early Irish Celtic language. That said, we know that from 2000 BC, tin mining started in Cornwall, and the Phoenicians traded directly with Cornwall. The name Britain comes from the Phoenician name Britannic, meaning land of tin. The Greek historian Herodotus describes how tin comes from the lands of tin that sat beyond Gaul.
The Greeks indicate that these people who were called Phoenicians included a lot more than just the city-states of Tyre, Sidon, and Byblos that you'll see along the coast of Lebanon. The Greek names in their histories, and Homer and others, record that the Phoenician term was applied to the whole east coast of the Mediterranean and included the land of Israel and Judah. Now, the Phoenician Empire had many, many colonies in the Mediterranean Sea area, the west coast of Europe, the west coast of Africa, and into the British Isles at least. Phoenicia had a colony in Britain. Carthage was a Phoenician colony. And evidence confirms that the Israelite Phoenician Empire came to North America. You won't read it in the standard history textbooks. You have to know what journals to go to in the colleges and the rather arcane archaeological journals and so forth. But the evidence is there. It's just not being passed out to people. The Phoenician Baal worshippers had fairly large colonies in America. As Barry Fell's book points out, they had a large temple to Baal in New Hampshire that's called Mystery Hill. In fact, I've seen it on the Discovery Channel, where it showed Barry Fell walking through the ruins of what was left. And frankly, there's not much left, because all you have is the basements of these buildings. Because when the American colonists came to New England, as they were building their cities and towns in New England, they needed building materials for streets and buildings. They found this complex of buildings. You know, brick buildings, it's on the New Hampshire-Massachusetts border, I think. They disassembled them, and they made their cobblestone streets out of these bricks. Well, when the Epigraphic Society, led by Barry Fell, realized that there were inscriptions at Mystery Hill in ancient Phoenician, Carthaginian, the Celtic languages, they were literally going with, you know, on the bricks that were still left that they could identify had come from that site, and they were looking for inscriptions with their magnifying glasses along the streets or on the sides of the building, and sure enough, finding them. Dedications to the pagan gods you read about in the Bible, Baal and Ashtaroth. And so they were over here. These date from about the 2nd millennium B.C. to the 800 to 600 B.C. range. In my area of the country, in Davenport, Iowa, they dug up a New World equivalent of a Rosetta Stone. Remember the three languages that were found in Egypt where they were able to decode the hieroglyphics of Egypt? A similar stone exists in a museum in Davenport, Iowa, to this day. It has three languages. It has the Punic Iberic, which is a descendant of Hebrew, the Egyptian hieroglyphics, and also the language of, when we say Libyan back then, it was really the sailors, the sea peoples of the Egyptians. It shows a maypole celebration, you know, with the fronds coming out from it, but it was a human sacrifice ceremony at that time. And so it's clear that they were still into the rather barbaric rites of the Baal worship. The Ten Commandments were found in ancient Hebrew on a stone tablet in Ohio. It was dug up in one of the mound builders, mounds that are through the Ohio River Valley. Well, it was dug up in 1860. What it showed was that it was a Semitic grave. They dug up a Ten Commandments Decalogue stone inscribed with a picture of Moses, the Ten Commandments in ancient Hebrew. It even had a strap hewn into the object, where you could put a hole for a strap, where you could put it over your back and travel. And also, even more impressive, is the Ten Commandments that is carved on a large inscribed stone in New Mexico. On the very highest part of the mountain, there's an inscription saying, Yahweh is our God. And this is the Hebrew from 1200 to 600 B.C., the Paleo-Hebrew, where they still wrote what we call the Tetragrammaton, the name of God. And in the rabbinic period, they didn't write that. So you can date it that it clearly goes before that period of time. Well, why aren't these facts in the history books? Now, Britain had been an Israelite colony for about 300 years when Samaria fell. Some tribes sailed for the British Isles. The Samoni, it's in the ancient records of Allen's book, arrived by sea, and he dates it to about 720 B.C. in Wales. The early Welsh called themselves also the Briths or the Brythonic Celts, or Celts. The Phoenicians had been present as miners and as traders, mining tin in that area for many, many years, even before their alliance with the Israelites. The Tuatha de Danann, or part of the tribe of Dan, obviously, arrived as well in the British Isles, principally in Ireland. A lot went a shorter distance to Carthage. But evidence exists that most of the Israelites did not go into captivity, nor did they make sea voyages to new lands, but instead migrated via land and conquered a new homeland in the Black Sea region. In 1875, an official of Queen Victoria's British government, Colonel Gawler, wrote a treatise called Our Scythian Ancestors Identified with Israel, citing many classical and medieval sources that most of the 10 tribes migrated north of Armenia and became the Scythians or Sakae of the Greek records by the Black Sea. Ortelius, who was a 16th century geographer for the Spanish king, wrote that when the Israelites migrated into the Caucasus, they took the name Gothi, which the Romans later called Goths. A medieval Jewish writer by the name of Eldad recorded, and I'm going to read his quote in direct quotes here, "Many Israelites did not go into captivity, but evaded the calamity, going off with their flocks and turning nomads, and that the chief or prince whom they appointed could muster 120,000 horsemen and 100,000 foot soldiers. So with an armed escort of 250,000 men," now if you figure 10,000 for a division, that's quite a few armed divisions going up in terms of armed strength. "This mass of Israelites, when you brought your wives and the children with you, the whole mass of people, easily numbered 1 or 2 million, perhaps more. When the Scythians or Sakae were located up in that Black Sea region," of course the Sakae was, again, I just picture the word Isaac, and Sakae is S-A-C-A-E. It has the syllable of Sak, Isaac or Itzak right in it. Herodotus, the Greek geographer, recorded, "Of these Scythians, it says that they make no offerings of pigs, nor will they keep them at all in their country." To the extent Scythia is ever discussed in the text, very likely very little, it probably does not mention that they were pretty much kosher in their approach to the meats. Idols were singularly absent in Scythian relics. A Scythian king was even executed for participating in a Greek, I think it was a Bacchanalian festival with the riotous, you know, drunkenness and so forth like that. Probably a lot like a Mardi Gras. But anyway, it's actually kind of an interesting story. Herodotus records it, that the Scythian king had adopted Greek ways, and he happened to arrange his schedule, so he was in Athens, I think it was at that time, of the festival of Bacchus. Another Scythian businessman was there and recognized him, essentially dressed in drag, going through the Mardi Gras festivals, where they dress up in all the bizarre costumes and cross-dress and everything. Well, that was the Scythian king enjoying himself that way, but Scythia was the largest wheat supplier to the city of Athens, so there were Scythians regularly there who were businessmen. He saw through the disguise, and the Scythians hunted down that king and wouldn't stop looking for him till they had executed him for that idolatry, because they did not permit that. Now, the Scythians gave the Israelite names to the rivers that emptied into the Black Sea when they got there. They used to have Greek names like the Ister, the Borysthenes, and I forget Tanae, I think, and I forget the other one. They gave it the names Danube, Dniester, Dnieper, and Don, all of them after the tribe of Dan, right after Israel got there. In about 624 BC, Scythia conquered all of Asia Minor, Mesopotamia. They passed through the area of Palestine, were at the borders of Egypt ready to invade when the Egyptian rulers gave them tribute to let them make them leave them alone. But Nineveh and the Assyrian Empire were effectively given the coup de grace as this. They ravaged the land of Mesopotamia. And you can see the revenge motive here, that Israel, who had been driven off its land, would love to come back and do payback to the Assyrian Empire, which they did. But the Scythians were very protective of the Jews in Judah, didn't harm them at all. This would have been during the reign of King Josiah, which is covered in the Bible. But it's interesting that at the time, secular history tells us that there was a lot of Scythians, or Sakae, in Palestine. The Bible, during the reign of Josiah, doesn't call them Scythians, or doesn't call them Sakae, but it says at that time that Josiah invited the people of Manasseh, the people of Ephraim, the remnant of Israel, or Israel, that were present there at the time of Josiah's reign, to join in the holy day. Since the Bible was written from the standpoint of the Hebrew people, it gives the Scythians their old Hebrew names, which were still very well known to the Jews, because only a century had gone by since they left. Now, Herodotus stated that the Scythians were a civilized people. Epiphanius, another Greek, stated that the laws, customs, manners of the Scythians were the standards of civility and polite learning. Now, we are taught in our textbooks that the Greeks and the Romans were the great civilizers, right? I mean, nobody could learn anything unless a Greek or a Roman learned it first, is the general propaganda we get. Many of our textbooks are repeating Greek and Roman propaganda, as I'll get to in just a minute. But this is an example where the Greeks themselves said that the Scythians were the standards of civilized behavior. Where do you think the Greeks got their civilization, or some or many of their civilized activities? From the Scythians. Paul, in Colossians 3:11, agrees. He draws a series of contrasts where he mentions the Scythians. Remember, he says that in Christ you're neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free, barbarian or Scythian. So Paul himself was using Scythian as the exact opposite of a barbarian, holding them up as the standards of civility, just what the Greeks said. In 528 BC, Cyrus the Great of Persia, who I'm sure you've heard about, attacked the Scythians living near the Caspian and Aral Sea. Persia attacked a main tribe of the Sakae called the Manasseh. Scythia was ruled at that time by a queen. Her name was Tamaris. But this queen was a tough lady, and when Cyrus the Great attacked, she warned him to stay out and told him he would get his fill of blood if he didn't leave. But they tried to keep the peace. Persia was the aggressor. The Scythians said, why don't you go back to your own place? We'll live in ours and let's avoid all this bloodshed. Persia would have none of it. So they attacked. Queen Tamaris led her army against the Persians. Cyrus the Great lost his life. He was killed there. Most of his army was destroyed, which the Greeks record of this battle. The Massagetae utterly crushed the Persian Empire, and yet you hardly hear about them in any of the history books. We hear about the losers, the Assyrians who lost to the Scythians, the Persians who lost twice to the Scythians again. And King Darius, then of Persia, tried for some revenge in about 512 BC. He led an army, bigger one this time. They had more respect for Scythia now. He led an army of 700,000 over in the Black Sea region of the Scythians. He didn't try to fight those ones on the east anymore. He went over to the west side to see if they were a little softer. Well, they had different tactics, just like the Russians used against Napoleon or against Hitler. They just had scorched earth. They pulled back into the immense, they filled in the wells behind them, gave nothing to the Persians. They extended their supply lines eventually too far, and it became untenable, and they all had to retreat. But the Persians lost 70,000 men in that particular engagement. Now, that's about what the United States lost in 14 years in Vietnam. And Persia lost that just in one campaign, lasting a few months. The one thing I do want to mention about this is the eagle was a common Scythian symbol and a clump of arrows being held in the talon of the eagle. Can you think of a modern country in the world that has its eagle crest with a clump of arrows as its war sign? The United States, which I identify as Manasseh, and that was the Massagetae of Scythia, had the same image. Carthage was a crown colony, just like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, you know, were crown colonies of Great Britain during when their kings had real power. The priests of Carthage were called the Kohanim, after the Kohens. The term rabbi was noticeable. Historians state that the sacrificial rites bore a very significant resemblance to the Book of Leviticus. The Encyclopedia Judaica also acknowledges that Hebrews, or Israelites from Palestine, were with the Phoenicians when they founded Carthage. Carthage grew strong and rich. They had such a powerful navy that for centuries they forbid the Greeks and Romans to even go out into the Atlantic. That was their private playground and their private domain, because they exploited the Atlantic world for their own wealth. And Carthage was known as an incredibly wealthy city. Carthage had Gibraltar, or as they called it, the Pillars of Hercules. That's one of the gates of their enemies. Frederick Pohl's book, Atlantic Crossings Before Columbus, quotes two Greek accounts of Carthage's secret Atlantic land. So they learned about it, they just couldn't go see it. One is a fairly respected source, Aristotle. He states, in the sea outside the Pillars of Hercules, the Carthaginians found a wilderness with navigable rivers. Carthage, the master of the Western Ocean, which meant the Atlantic, observed that many people attracted by the fertile soil and pleasant climate resided there. Carthage decreed no one else under penalty of death would be allowed to sail there. They kept the land secret. Another Greek writer wrote, there lies a very great island in the vast ocean, many days sail westward from Africa. The soil is fruitful, a great part of it is mountainous, but there's a large plain watered with several navigable rivers, you know, the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Ohio, etc. The mountainous part is clothed with very large woods. Well, obviously, this is North America, and the Greek histories also record that the Carthaginians sent fleets with tens of thousands of settlers out through the Pillars of Hercules. They assumed they were going to colonies in Africa or Europe, but frankly, there isn't a population base there to indicate that that is where they went. And now, through the work of Barry Fell and the Epigraphic Society, we know a lot of those colonists came to our side of the Atlantic. Carthaginian coins, writings, and artifacts have been found in Colorado, New York, Alabama, Georgia, Connecticut, Nevada, and other places. But why is this fact? Why are these facts not in textbooks? Well, obviously it's being suppressed. But the fact is, The Phoenicians and Carthaginians sailed the oceans for centuries. They knew the world was round about a millennium before the Greeks learned it. So we have this myth that the Greeks were the founders of all civilization, when in fact the Phoenicians and Carthaginians would be just absolutely amazed if they could be resurrected now and see that their ancient propaganda was being taught as facts, because the Greeks got this world is flat notion from a disinformation campaign from the Phoenicians and Carthaginians. They knew the wealth that was out on the other side of the Atlantic and other places. They wanted to scare everybody else away. So they invented those maps you see in the ancient world where it shows these monstrous sea creatures that would just gobble ships, you know. So the Carthaginians invented that to scare their enemies off the ocean so they could have a monopoly. And they understood latitude and longitude. They knew how to navigate with the trade winds and the currents back and forth across the oceans with no difficulty. But the Greeks, for example, were so ignorant of this that at one point the Carthaginian navy, which usually blocked the Pillars of Hercules, was gone on a war. A Greek sailor from Marseille, France, named Pythias, sailed through the Pillars of Hercules and started going north in the direction of Britain. He was absolutely amazed to see that the constellations changed position in the sky further north he went. He went back and told the Greek world, the earth must be round, or the positions of the stars is changing. It's like I'm sailing on a sphere going, you know. They all laughed him to scorn and said, no, of course, you know, it's flat. And so that's where our great Greek civilization also was deceived by the Carthaginians. Well, Carthage did have an entire civilization here. Historians discuss two mysterious civilizations in ancient America, the Adena people, who inhabited the Ohio River Valley. They can identify from about 1000 B.C. onward. Now, that's the time of King David and Solomon, when they were sending fleets across the ocean, until they merged with the Hopewell people around 300 to 200 B.C. They died out centuries later, but 300 to 200 B.C. is a key time as well. That's the time of the Punic Wars, when the Carthaginians were losing to the Romans and more of their people left for their colonial system as refugees. The Presidents Jefferson and Harrison were about the mound builders. They were wondering if these weren't built by the lost tribes of Israel. And one of the artifacts in an Adena grave was translated by Barry Fell as Punic in the form of an alphabet used in Iberia, that was in Carthage's territory, in the first millennium B.C. It was a language of Carthage, which was from the Hebrew. So as soon as they found out that, oh, there's Semitic goods in these mounds, we don't want to dig up anymore. You know, the establishment didn't want to find out anything more there. There were Semitic names and grave goods. They even had copper hides. Those of you who, you know, it was a form of ancient currency. It was a copper that looked like a rectangle with hooks on it. And they've even dug those up in American sites.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist and author. My published work can be found on Amazon.com. Please check it out. And thank you for leaving a positive review. Please remember to subscribe to my YouTube channel, which is close to getting its 100,000th subscriber. So thank you for all the support. Our other YouTube channel called Atlantean Gardens is also at about 100,000 subscribers. Thanks again for sharing these videos and for the support on Patreon. Your donations are greatly appreciated. And I look forward to uploading a lot of new content this year. So please leave me your thoughts in the comment section. Stay well, and I will see you next time.